Fascinating, I think, that Mr. Teague was able to, in a sense, get outside of the interior matrix that he had been in largely, and found himself, in a sense, pioneering in mass market prefabricated housing. But there was still the attention to interior detail. In other words, for comfort, for utility, and for a pleasant interior design, was there not?
Yes, that's correct. But the potential for doing what you wanted with it was there to project your own image within the framework of what was supplied in his initial shell.
Was it successful? Was the prefabrication of the house?
That I can't answer because I was out in the Tules.
How did it go?
There was some so, but at that time the need for housing was, I think, met by people like Levitt and other builders out there who were building houses, and not some of them were qualified to do it.
Yeah,
speed
was of the essence.
Yes, speed was of the essence, and this was a lot of development work to still be done on the Teague house. Mm-hmm. But they were, as Mr. Teague said, even handkerchief merchants, he said, from New York, people who had been in the manufacturer of women's clothes and actors got into the building of homes. There was a lot of money in it in 1945 and 46 and 47, when the young soldier who came home was married and had saved his money because he couldn't spend it looking for homes.
Right.
And it was now, it was now, not. So these houses were being, like in the Long Island area, coming up like mushrooms, and that's when Mr. Teague was appalled by the fact that you had no choice in the decoration of the house. Taking the Levitt house, it was you got it. Everything was, you had no say. Even the roof, the color of the roof, the shingles on your house, the paint in the room,
had been predetermined.
All being determined, and it was no change.
Mm-hmm.
So your house, from the inside, looked like every other house.
But this turned out to be sort of an interim kind of thing, although there are people who lived in Levittown for many years.
Oh, yes, I lived there.
But because it was comfortable and
yes, and he did a lot. He did a lot for you, and he gave you a home that you could move into. It was spotlessly clean when you moved in. It had the blinds on the window, and it had something that most people didn't have in those days. It had a clothes washer.
Mm-hmm.
And he just moved in, and Levitt in the Levittown group, you moved in there at $55 a month because you weren't able to buy the house. And at the end of a year, you had a lease, but at the end of the year, we were able to buy the house for $6,990.
Bargain.
And a house today, you can buy one of those houses for less than $70,000 or $80,000.
A bunch of Levittown remained. Some of Levittown remained, or has been bulldozed, or is it still,
oh no,
still
oh,
there?
Oh, no, sure, it's still there.
Good.
Yes. And I lived in two houses in Levittown, and I sold them at fantastic gains and money. And those houses are, I would say, as attractive today as when I moved out. People did then start to. Customers,
yeah.
Yes, and they did turn out to be pretty nice places. In fact, Miss Gorn's sister lives in one.
She lives in one, and yeah, her house is worth. She moved in. She paid $15,000 for it, and today it's worth $100,000 because that land is so valuable,
right.
On Long Island.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where was it located physically?
It was located. North, about 6 or 7 miles north of Hempstead.
Oh, yeah.
And in a small area called Island Trees, which is a beautiful name. But Mr. Rabbit, like most people, had an ego. And that wasn't long before his lawyers were working on having a call every time.
So I take it the Teague prefabricated house didn't get off the ground in terms of commercial.
They were sold.
But it remained a rather interesting concept that exceeded the Levittown, the then Levittown formula.
Yes.
Well, this is an era of great expansion. What kind of feeling did you have at the firm? Mr. Teague is still very much in control of his destiny, and is still very much his faculties are still unimpaired. What vision did he have for the post-war future of industrial design in America in terms of projects and products and areas in which to expand?
Well, at that time we were expanding in almost every area. We began to bring in disciplines that were not here before. Transportation, for one. We had not been in that area. We did during that period, our architectural group increased quite a bit.
Yes. Now, did this mean that you had an in-house architectural group which would advise the firm on architectural projects, or would they do architectural projects?
They would do architectural
projects. They would
do
them,
yes.
So you added that service to your...
Yes. We didn't practice architecture, and we don't practice it today. By our charter, we say we do not practice architecture or engineering. We are not the architects of record, but we did influence the architecture, I think, in the Air Force Academy. That was the largest project ever given to an industrial landowner.
What was the dimensions of that?
Well, one of the, I think we can best describe it, is that we had promised the president that he would, before he left office, would receive a first class graduate.
Which president was that?
It was a tremendous working with Skidmore, Owen and Merrill, the architects, who did not have, I don't think at that time, have an interior group.
Mm-hmm.
And the Air Force came to us because of the fact that we were more than just interior, the decorators and designers. That they felt that we could take care of the tremendous logistic problems, which we did. I mean, it's all right to design chairs and to help in selecting the manufacturer, but then when the chairs start coming in, there they are, different for chairs, different colors, different purposes. My God, that could become a problem. What to do with them?
What was the setup in terms of you offered a multi-service approach to a project, and yet you obviously did not manufacture any of the projects. What sort of a feeling did you have for did you then recommend suppliers to the client, or did the client himself or itself engage the supplier?
No, it was an unusual project, and the simple reason that, according to the rules, we had to write specifications for the thousands of products that had to go in. We could not specify any manufacturer. So therefore, in order to put up the bid package, we had to write the specification.
Mm-hmm.
And that went from the typewriters, the furniture, anything that was going into that complex. We had to write the specification. We had to document it. We then worked with the procurement section of the Air Force Academy, the purchasing.
Right.
We went out on, if they put out the bid and they had the bid packages were returned, then we had to go with them, and I think the word was qualify, to make sure that the manufacturer was could complete the order.
Mm-hmm.
And the procurement officer or the purchasing officer at the Air Force Academy had to look at their capabilities and also their financial picture to make sure that if given the contract, they could indeed complete it.
So they relied on your expertise to work with them on suppliers.
That's right. In other words, we would help them with their inspections too during the manufacture of the items themselves. Now, some, I think, in some cases, what the order for, let's say, seating was such a huge order that it was given out to a few manufacturers. The silverware, we even designed the silverware for them. We had to work with them on getting that manufactured, the plates, you name it. It was part of the job.
Was this a first in industrial design where you took over a complete
I would say it was, yes.
Organization and did it from top to bottom?
Yes, I think it was, yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, yes, it was a tremendous project. And we had teams in New York, we had teams in Colorado working right there at the Air Force Academy, the contemporary Air Force Academy. They had classes going. They had their first class in there.
Did they?
They were on the field at Colorado Springs. We worked with the heads of the academy. The project we worked with at Skidmore's and Merrill office, we had a liaison person there, and we had a team right on the Air Force Academy site. The temporary offices, place, and then back in New York.
And that must have been the wonder of the industry that you were able to. Come up with those.
It was the best kept secret.
Oh, I see. They didn't know much about it.
We didn't take advantage of it. It was one of the real sad things at that time in our history. PR was not looked upon as necessary. I don't know why.
You didn't blow your own horn.
No, we didn't do it.
It just made it a little bit into the interior design field. I mean, there was a cover story in Interior Design magazine, so that it wasn't really unknown. But I think in a broader interior design discipline, I don't think it was as recognized, mm-hmm. or in the architectural discipline.
Yeah. In terms of design, was there you must have employed a series of layers of designers, of interior designers, of a person who worked on color, a person who worked on modular design, perhaps an overall creative head of design?
Yes, we had a head of that project, a man by the name of Carl Conrad, the head of the project. A very creative fellow, was one of the partners of the firm. Unfortunately, not long after he finished that job, he was involved in a very serious automobile accident and became vegetable. And that happened in 1961, and he has, I don't think he knows his own name. He's still alive.
Does that leave a rather
in the architectural. Well, we were lucky enough to have Bob Harper, who was an architect.
He stayed on.
He was there. He stayed on until 19.
He left you alone at Boeing and came back to New York. Mr. Teague, of course, died in 1960, right?
Yes.
So he was with you throughout this project.
Oh, yes.
What sort of input did he have?
Well, he had quite a heavy input. he watched the development of it.
When
we
had
meetings with the design group, mm-hmm. Was very critical of the work they did.
Mm-hmm.
Was after to have him brought up to date, mm-hmm. had meetings with the design group. Yes, he played a very active role in that project.
Was he supportive of this type of this must have been quite a part of it, a logical outgrowth, an expansion, but a rather rapid one. Did he think this is the way the firm should go in the 60s?
Well, he was critical of this turnkey operation that seemed to be a lot of firms were demanding of the designers, such in the, especially exhibit work. He felt we were designers and we should not get involved in these mass purchasing that they were, some of the companies wanted. They wanted us to take and not only design the exhibit, have it installed and turn it over to them and the key and say it is yours, open the door and you know, you've got nothing. He said we're designers and we should not get involved in that. He was critical of especially the jobs we were doing in these smaller fairs throughout the world, where we took on, he claimed, just too much responsibility as designers. We got into purchasing of items. There was one we did, I remember, where we were creating what would, I think was called the typical American life, and the house was built. That was the one that Simpson supplied, the lumber for. Do you remember the redwood?
It was the garden over in Brussels.
Brussels.
Yeah.
But
redwood. They were supplying redwood.
Yeah.
Redwood from their redwood mill.
But we, for some unknown reason, got involved with planting the shrubbery outside this place, and it called for the purchase of vast amounts of shrubs and trees and bushes, and it was a
fencing.
Was that?
And fencing.
And fencing, yes. What happened, we purchased the trees and put them on the dock, and they died. And Mr. Digg, that was what he needed to set him off on this thing, is that we should not get involved in that. That's not our business. Let's never do it again. And he didn't believe in the turnkey. In the case of the Air Force Academy, he was interested in design, but when it got down to this massive documentation and so forth, he had little or no patience for that at all.
How did the rest of you feel about that?
Well, we've...
We had to eat.
I think that's it. If you want to, you know, if you want to eat, you have to do it. And that was one of the major reasons why we they came to us and why we did the job. It was the basic reason that they felt they needed an organization that was more than just a, as I say, designers, and that we could keep the records that they needed. They were not capable. Don't forget, the Air Force Academy was in its very early days.
Right.
And they had this tremendous project thrown on them with people that were bringing back officers from World War II who had been in certain building projects, such as they had the man who was in charge of purchasing had worked as part of this lend-lease business with Britain and the Allies. They knew nothing about this, but what they really wanted was a group of people that could come in and take over and help them and run this thing, keep accountability for them. Didn't have any staff.
Well, Mr. Teague, notwithstanding, you were building, in a sense, the modern design service organization.
Yes. And he recognized that, but he had little patience for that.
But he had the good sense not to
No, he didn't like it, and he stated he didn't like it, and with that he forgot about it. It was now your problem.
Well, then, in the mid to late 60s, then you really laid the foundation for an organization which could offer, within reason, almost any service in the designed product design, construction, architectural engineering.
Well, I think we're unique in the fact that not many designers, I don't know of any that have, quote, an engineering section.
Yeah.
And that was unusual for a company like us, to an industrial design company. I happen to be chairman of the professional design, professional design firm management groups, and I talked to them about, do they have engineering capabilities, and they really don't.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't have it. And I think that in that case, we are unique. Mr. Tigg, I think, was responsible for bringing in the engineering to some great extent.
Yeah, you realized early on that you needed expertise in several fields.
He was very interested in architecture. I think if he had to pick a field that he wanted to be in, I think probably would have been architect.
Mm-hmm.
He had a great feeling for it. Packaging didn't really come into the TIG organization until I think the early 50s.
Mm-hmm. This was another explosion, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. And at one time, I would say that the packaging group was one of our largest groups. But I think today we could say that it contributes quite a bit to our income.
It started, actually, it started in 1958 when P&G came in.
Procter & Gamble wanted to do a campaign for them.
We had two people in the late 40s and early 50s.
Excuse me, I forgot about the Schaefer
Brewing Company, yes. And also, remember Charles Antel? Remember the people with the hair?
One of the early hair groups.
Yes, and they were on television. I think one of the first advertisers on television with the large opening so they could get you cans in there to put that stuff on. We had two people. And as the packaging grew, we started to bring in people who, at that time in the field, we couldn't find too many people who really were into packaging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we trained them here through some people who had some knowledge of it. And I think we, during the 50s, 60s, and 70s, we grew in that area.
So in a sense, you didn't design simply the lettering, the logo, colors, you designed the whole package,
yes, and we have quite a record of patents on packaging. I think we, with the Procter & Gamble, I guess we did most of the physical packaging of their products for many years. You look at a lot of the bottles and the devices, Jig had a big hand in that.
Was there a field that you felt comfortable in, or did you expand to almost every product field?
Almost every product field.
There was no feeling of being hemmed in.
I think one of the things that we wanted to be was a complete design service.
Yeah.
I always felt that if a client came to us and had a design problem, we could handle it. But then we could grow with him in all of his problems of design. The idea is that we took some small accounts and we helped to grow with them.
Could you maybe give us a sort of a case history of a successful product design of the late 50s, early 60s that field was a pioneering effort?
Yeah, there were so many of them.
What stands out in your mind as successful
a product?
Pardon?
Product or package?
Well, perhaps a combination of both.
There's been so many of them.
For instance, did you create a whole line for Procter & Gamble? How did that work out?
Well, we worked in powder and food. We worked in
We worked for General Foods, we worked for Procter & Gamble, we worked for IMC.
General Foods. Were these largely
American Standard?
What year is that?
It was in the 50s, too.
Uh-huh. I can't wrap myself around it.
Well, there's such a proliferation of products you worked on, so that there didn't seem to be a pattern of single image or vision that the company projected. When a company wanted to either design a new product or design a new product line or to package a new product line, Why did they think of Walter Garten Teague Associates? In what way did they think of us?
Well, I think they thought of us because we had all the disciplines under one roof.
Uh-huh.
We could take care of their packaging, the physical packaging of the product. We could do the graphics. We could help them with their marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And we can do that. And I think they thought, well, that they could start and we could take over and do a family, I guess the word is image,
mm-hmm.
of all their products,
mm-hmm.
get into the corporate identity for them, and they felt comfortable at knowing that they had it all under one roof.
Did they feel that you were up to date, au courant with the latest in design, fashions, and colors,
well,
and fabrics?
We are doing now something that most firms, I don't think of any design firm has really tried it yet. We're celebrating our 60th year. And we thought it was a pretty good time to take a look at ourselves. So working with a group from Boston, we are looking at our image and how we are perceived, not only by our clients, present clients, past clients, prospects, and our own staff. And that will be a year-long project. We're just about finishing up the three-quarter mark, if you can say that. And what we did, we gave these people the list of our clients that we have now and the past clients, and they called them and spoke to the people. And we gave them a list of all the clients, and they picked those which they thought would be interesting. And we found out a lot about ourselves. Because what we're doing now, we're looking at ourselves from the past and the present, but we are looking for a future and what we have to do to meet that future. What I'd like to do is to read you the statement that we came up with. We had a meeting, a seminar meeting for 3 days in Clark, New Jersey, which we brought our people in from all the different areas of the country and the different disciplines. And together we created what we call a task statement. And then that task statement says what we hope we are building for WDTA in the future. It took a lot of courage. As this group that I belong to and we belong to, because it's not any individual, it's the firm who belongs to it, said they don't know if they would have the courage to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You hear a lot of things that you can feel pretty proud of, and then you hear a couple of things that says that we don't like what you're doing. You know, but
had you had any internal review mechanisms in the past?
No.
Yes,
and also meetings and so forth. But this is the first time where a group actually went to our own employees and sat down with them in interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And what we promised that we did not, we, the management of WDTA, were not interested in who said it, the very fact that it was said. Now we have those reviews, and they are in booklets that we have to, you can't hide, they're funny all the time. And there are some things in there that were disturbing about us.
You got a little too complacent.
Yes, we did. We had major accounts, and those major accounts have been with us for many, many years, such as the Boeing account. But as I think Frank taught us many years ago, don't be that complacent. Things can change pretty rapidly. I think this report that we have will do us a lot of good. Could I ask you, I need to get a copy of that, please? Because I think that it best describes what we feel we need to survive in the future. I gave a talk at a banquet, was it 3 weeks ago, which Mr. Alitas and I made up And it was like, we know that there are challenges out there. There are great challenges. And they are important that we address them now. And wait.
This is a memo dated June 26, which is yesterday, that Edward Kibble wrote to the staff of WDTA. And the subject is WDTA's planning and development program, which is essentially a status report to date of that program Ed has just been telling you about, the image study and the corporate management meeting and so on. And I'll just read it to you. As many of you know, since January, WDTA has been involved in a year-long planning and development program with consultant Carol Harper of Media Rights. The program is aimed at helping us chart our course for the future so that we can become the kind of company we want to be. This involves choices, of course. Working with Carol and her associate, Catherine Catlin of Choice Points, we have undertaken an image study of WDTA to determine how we are viewed by clients and prospects. We have completed an internal assessment of how you, our staff, regard our strengths and weaknesses. With this necessary information in hand, we held a 3-day workshop meeting in Clark, New Jersey, which we call Designing the Vision. Key management from every major WDTA office around the country attended, and it was one of the most important meetings WDTA has ever had. We sat down and spent many hours seeking to express our mission in words. The vision and ideas that motivate us as a company and signify how we want to participate in the world. After much deliberation, we summed up our mission thus: to enhance our reputation for design and engineering excellence, to assist clients in solving their problems, to enhance man's quality of life, to provide an environment that affords professional and personal satisfaction and growth opportunities for our employees, to make enough money to sustain continuity and goals, to continuously perceive needs to meet the challenges of the future. We also agreed on our goal for the year, which is to make our New York and other general industrial design offices more profitable as soon as possible. Currently, we are in the third phase of the four phases of the program. This phase is aimed at implementing our vision for the future through creative planning and problem solving, team building, skills development, marketing, and the production of communication tools. During May and June, we have been holding sessions with everyone in the New York office, management, design, administrative, and sales, to address basic issues such as communications, cooperation, how to plan together. These skills will facilitate our getting things done easily and well as we move toward achieving our goals. Sessions also give all of us in New York the opportunity to participate together in contributing to our progress. But the program is not restricted just to New York. What we learn about working together creatively and constructively will rub off elsewhere. It will affect performance and policies company-wide. And as our goals in New York move toward accomplishment, we can turn our attention to the other areas as needed. Carol Harper has some very definite ideas about her consulting work. This is a quote. There is no book or formal format that we've written and are following because the creative problem-solving process is interactive. One thing affects the other, and each change affects everything else, which is why we're constantly redesigning our program as we go along. We're not working like consultants who tell clients what to do. The changes really have to come from within, or they're not going to be lasting. It's a long, slow process. But the idea is to make changes happen in a way that you support and want, at the pace you're comfortable with, unquote. We will soon wind up our last session for the summer. In September, we will resume with more training sessions, and we will develop a comprehensive marketing plan. Soon after that, we will go into production of a new multimedia show on WDTA, the cornerstone of our battery of marketing tools. We will also create a new brochure. June 26 marks the day Walter Derwin Teague opened America's first industrial design office 60 years ago. Someday hence, I hope we will look back and take note of 1986 as the year that WDTA made another beginning.
fascinating. Then you are really in the forefront of a broad gauge, multi-service design field or concern, and you're looking.
That is mapping out the next 5 to 10 years.
10 years. I wonder if I might ask Aileen if she would give us a word picture of the female in a major design firm. You are pretty much the senior female on the staff, I suspect.
Yes, I am.
And I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the about how it was in those days. You came here when Mr. Teague was still here.
Yes, I did.
And you may have been hired by, or at least. We have talked to him about what he wanted in terms of a female employee.
No, I never really had a personal interview with Mr. Teague. Mr. Kibble hired me, and I was a typist, and then I became a stenographer, and I did, you know, see Mr. Teague, and he did. Was very cordial, and I did in the background. I did do some work for Mr. Teague, and my impression of Mr. Teague is, you know, I was a very young girl, and he was awesome to me. And he wasn't tall in stature, but the way he carried himself and presented himself, he was tall, and he was. Very nattily dressed. He had kind of a very distinguished look.
He was he reserved, or was he?
He was a very reserved man and cordial, and
not too gregarious.
No. And at times at the Christmas party or something like that, it was a whole new image of him because he could be so, you know, outgoing, humorous. And charming,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And at that time, he would make you feel welcome. He would shake hands with the staff, and he would clasp both his hands around yours and tell you, you know, you were welcome. And he was just distinguished, and you just knew that this man knew what he was doing, you know. And when I came, it was a very busy organization. We had press parties, and there was, I remember there was a big Boeing 707 mock-up. All the staff went to the mock-up, and we were given a, you know, dinner and shown around the plane, and Mr. T gave us a talk, and there was a lot of spirit, a lot
Where was
of spirit.
That mock-up, located?
It was located at 56th Street on the west side. Was it 58?
28th Street.
Was it 28?
Stoward Lehigh.
Okay, all right. We moved then up to 58th. I'm sorry, it was downtown, right? That's right. But there was a lot of spirit, and we were very busy. You know, we had a lot of graphics work, and we had work for Ritter Dental, and we had the Barcolo, and we had Colonial Stores and R.H. Stearns, and we had exhibit work. And it was a very flourishing, exciting company. And
when did you begin to move out of the scenographic phase into a sort of an administrative phase or administrative assistant phase?
Oh, not for many years. I was a secretary for a good many years. I was secretary to Mr. Harper, and then I was secretary to Mr. Del Judas here for 10 years. I was secretary to Mr. Harper for 10
sure
years.
I'm sure you were much more than a secretary. You were undoubtedly say that. A confidant, an administrative assistant, an expediter.
Yeah. We, and from there, I work right now with Nick in public relations and do some security work, and I help Mr. Kibble at different times, but I mean it's always been an interesting job. There's always been changes, and And it's a different, today is different too for the female, say the female designer.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a designer, but I'm in the administration, and I think even in the administration, and it's a little different today than it was X number of years ago.
There's no longer a male preserve. Women are moving.
No, I can see where Mr. Kibble is, you know, taking the woman into the forelight, really, more or less the forefront. And as far as designers, women in design, I think they are stepping forward too and becoming more key people in the field.
There are more women designers on the staff?
Yes.
Has it become a no longer a rarity, obviously?
It was in the beginning. But more and more they're coming. And also, I think in most design organizations, that women are moving ahead.
Mm-hmm.
They're becoming more a part of the organization. We have now a director of personnel is a woman.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a man.
Right.
And trying to describe this thing and the way people perceived it here, I think my wife tells the story, and I think it's so humorous. When my wife, I've known my wife since we were 17, 18, and I was working here. She was going to school locally, and we had a date, and she would come to the office and wait outside in the conference room for me. And occasionally, Mr. T, on his way out, would stop and talk to her. And she always felt that when Mr. T did that, it was almost like talking to God, because he would be very formal with her, but she said he was awesome, you know, to her, because she was only 17 or 18 years old at the time. Many years later, I will say 5 years ago, 6 years ago, we had here what we call old timers, and it was people who had been with the organization from the beginning, and for people who had been with the company at least 25 years. And at that meeting was Dawn Ting. Now Dawn and my wife were always friendly, and Doris was talking to him, and she said, you know, Dawn, I always looked upon your father like, you know, like God. And she said, when he spoke to me, it was like talking to God. And he looked at him and he said, Doris, you don't think I'm Jesus Christ, do you?
Well, that seemed to have been the pattern of the early days. You had these really seminal figures who created industrial design, and they remained almost godlike creatures.
Yes.
And yet, you people obviously have turned the from the cult of personality, made the best of it, and yet turned it into a full-fledged, broad-gauged.
We've actually turned it into a business.
Business, right?
In 1972, in our first board meeting, when Mr. Del Judas took over as president and chief executive officer of the company at the board of directors meeting, it was discussed. Frank, I think, started the discussion on the basis of Superstar. I think Nick will tell you that it was very difficult in 1972, and it is still to this day, and Nick can correct me, that it is much easier to get public relations for a firm that has this superstar, you know, the glamorous, the glamorous person of the days of Lowy, and even today you have certain people who are looked upon as superstars. But Frank didn't want it, and wanted to make sure that the most important part of our public relations trust would be the team aspect, working together as a team. And we've tried to maintain that. No tier. In a message that Frank and I both give to the board of directors and to the staff in our reports and to the stockholders at WDTA, we say, no superstar, just a super team. And that's what we mean. That means that when the quote superstar dies, the organization doesn't die with it. That happened with the Lowy organization.
Yes.
Right after Mr. Lowy gave up the ghost of being active in the company disappeared.
There was no substance.
No.
Yeah.
You know, this way, by bringing together groups of talented people who work together as a team, makes a big difference that, for that continuation of it. We're celebrating our 60th year, and we are now, I would say, as large as we've ever been. Our revenues are larger than they ever had. We just had our annual meeting yesterday, to be frank with you.
You've gone public in recent years?
No.
Oh, you still haven't gone public?
We are still a small. But what we have has opened up the possibility of, but the, we have in fact opened up that people working on the staff who have decided to make a career can become shareholders in WPA.
Uh-huh. Have a stake in the firm.
That's right. And we have now, which started with approximately 10 shareholders when Mr. Teague, about 8 or 9 years after Mr. Teague died, to where we have now 26 shareholders. And as people retire from the organization or unfortunately die, the shares are bought back by the corporation and then will become part of an ongoing stock or share plan.
What privileges does the shareholder have in terms of financial return and say in the company?
He attends the shareholders' meetings. He does elect the board of directors, the real force in the organization, who then they elect the officers of the corporation. But he does sit in on all the board of stockholders' meetings. We do disclose to him the financial picture of the organization. And he has the ability at these meetings to talk out about things. The survey that we made gave him the ability to talk out, not only him, but everybody in the organization. And that went on these training sessions from John Powell, our clerk, to I sit on them in the meetings, on these training sessions. And they have all of absolute right to say what's on their mind. And I think it's when you become a shareholder, you have the opportunity then, of course, of voicing these opinions.
In terms of the direction in a philosophy of design, I think you've indicated that you held pretty closely to the vision of the founder. Has that in any way confined you, or were you able to break out into new directions?
We have never felt confined by any primary philosophical control, because the underlying basis for any design is that you have to design to the requirements of the problem. And if you design to the requirements of the problem, then you apply the visuals that relate to the classical characteristics and update them to today's and tomorrow's. You can project them into the future. So there's nothing really. The only thing that ever controls a good design is proportion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's whether it's the length and width of a line or the length and width of a mass, in either two dimensions or three dimensions.
You see any in the next century, do you see revolution occurring in design philosophy, or will it pretty much follow an evolutionary path?
Well, I think primarily it will be an evolutionary kind of thing, because it will come in small revolutionary outbreaks, but the entity will be kind of an evolutionary situation.
You don't see any radical departure?
No.
Today's?
No, it all looks good on a sketch, but it's still the hardware still takes all the space.
Exactly. The
modes of propulsion still require whatever the power sources and the fuels. So until things are really developed to reduce the scale of a lot of that stuff. And the human body, if it's going to be for human consumption and or human transportation, the physical characteristics of the human being are really getting larger, and everything else is getting more sleek. And they've got to, and you, the economics will dictate whether how much waste sleek you can put on the end of each whatever it might be, in order to make it look like that needle that you'd like it to look like. You can maybe always make it look like an egg, more better than a needle, for instance. I don't know whether that responds to your question.
Were there any design projects that any of you wish hadn't occurred over the history of the company? Are there any that you're less enthusiastic about than others? Some of you might like to shove under the rug, looking back.
I can't think of anything out there. I don't know what might have. Well, there have been some projects probably that have caused internal tensions.
Really? What type of projects?
Well, they were just these caused personalities. Command positions.
Power struggles.
Things that cause power struggles. Uh-huh. Those I wish never happened. Yeah, that's the kind of thing I wish never happened. And I think, but as far as the actual assignment, some of them are dull, some of them are just what you have to do. Bread and butter is important, and if you have to tabulate something, you have to tabulate it.
And it's an award winning.
No,
please God.
That's one of the things that's almost never taken into consideration, and that is the fact that we can't all be doing award-winning designs, number one. And number two, award-winning designs don't last very long.
Oh, really?
And they're kind of expensive to produce in many instances.
Were there any products?
Very attractive visually, they're very nice, there's no question about it, and they deserve what they get.
Don't work sometimes. Mm. Were there any products that didn't work? I was thinking, looking back on it, were there any projects where the client was less than satisfied, or or looking back on it, did you feel that that one or two products could have been improved in time or money available for the client, patients?
Well, I think in many, in some cases, it's because the client, the client's limitations as well as.
Yeah, I'm sure there are.
Yeah, yeah, where the client, no matter, excuse me, what you gave him, it may be a, even with his equipment on, he just couldn't produce it. Well, I don't know of any that we have failed that way, though.
Yeah.
We try very hard, and the way we work is to work as part of the client's team and to check with him along the way. We have checkpoints along the way, and I don't think we ever get too far away from what the client really needs. And one of the things we try very hard to do is to make the client look good. That's our job.
Right.
If we can do that, it's most important. And our designers, I think, know that there are limitations to what the designer can do. I mean, that the firm can do, the client.
You described Mr. King as being a very good salesman, a very good public relations man in his own right, a master of client relations. Do you have an organization, a unit within the organization called client relations?
Yes, I would say that we have our PR people, we have our sales people. But if you want to include in that, the best would be the head of the project
manager. Right.
We call them design directors.
Design directors.
I think they're our best PR people. I think they're our best salesmen, because what they do is work so closely with the client.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that this is an incredible history of a very successful company. Never been involved with schlock products, and has always had a philosophy of producing the best services and the best product. Seems to be an exemplary of record.
We'd like to keep it up.
I'd like to talk to Mr.
Politis,
Nick Politis, who is your communications consultant, at some length, if I may. Brought about your coming to the firm, and is your discipline a fairly recent one in terms of design? Your position, not your discipline, your position in this firm, is that a fairly recent innovation in terms of bringing in the communications consultants to the firm?
Not at all. Certainly, there's a long tradition, you know, perhaps going back to the 50s, perhaps earlier, as far as I know, of design firms working with public relations people or communication, whatever they call themselves, so that by the time I came here in 1974, that was well established, and there had been really quite a succession of people before I was here. I knew some of them personally, and was well acquainted with them. But in 1974, I guess there was a period where WDTA was looking for a new relationship, client-consultant relationship, mm-hmm. and I don't recall, it must have been a personal contact of mine or whatever that put us in touch together, and we began talking, and we became associated in that year. Mm-hmm. And when I started working with, I've worked throughout the 12 or 13 years most closely with Frank and Ed, and that's it. I mean, yeah. There have been the two people I've worked most closely with, and initially I was working I would say, primarily on public relations, on getting publicity on various projects that the firm had done. And then, gradually over the years, I think as we worked together and other things began to happen, it became a much more broad-based kind of relationship. I mean, one of the things that happened is we started getting much more actively involved in marketing, and so I became the marketing communications, you know, writer and consultant and things like that. And I was also doing it, doing marketing communications for WDTA's clients. And then I got involved in doing, in some instances, doing business proposals to our clients, prospective clients. And then I think a few years ago we were invited to teach at Yale University a seminar in industrial design, and Frank Del Judas and I were both appointed visiting lecturers for a semester, and gave a course which we think is the first course in industrial design that was ever given at Yale, perhaps in the way we did it, in any you know, humanities school, as apart from you know, a specialized design department. And I've worked in the meantime on such things with that as future development programs. I've done a lot of you know, exhibits and writing and things like that.